Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings, welcome again to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. One of the writers and blogs that I follow is the American conservative's Rod Dreher, who is the author of the must-read book Live Not by Lies, among others that I recommend. Some people consider him an alarmist on some issues, and certainly a lot of the wokeness that he writes about is daunting, if not frightening, to consider. But I think he's right on target about the scary directions that our culture is taking. The other day, he posted a short video clip of Yuval Noah Harari, is the best-selling philosopher of the book Homo Deus, who has become a favorite of all the globalist elites who are salivating over the next level of human evolution, something called transhumanism. Harari in this video is addressing an audience about what he calls the hacking of humanity. He declares that human beings are simply algorithms, and that we can be liberated from our ignorance about ourselves and our free will by an advanced, all-knowing algorithm that will show us the way to the next level of humanity. Rod Dreher reminds us that in Harari's book Homo Deus, he wrote, quote, "Having raised humanity above the beastly level of survival struggles, we will now aim to upgrade humans into gods and turn Homo sapiens into Homo Deus," unquote. Deus, of course, is Latin for God. So the new biotechnology Harari is exulting over will make us as gods. Sound familiar? Book of Genesis, maybe? The serpent's seductive promise in the Garden of Eden? Is that ringing a bell? This is one of the most frightening visions of the future of humanity that I could possibly envision. Harari and his audience were just drooling over it, partly because there are billions of dollars to be made from pursuing this path, and partly because it will lead to the utter domination of the rest of humanity by these techno-elites. As scary as this is, it's only one part of what is being called the Great Reset, which many of you no doubt have heard of, and you may think it has only economic designs, but you may not be aware of the sinister depth and breadth of this agenda that is already underway and beginning to impact every aspect of our lives. My guest coming up in just a moment has written a riveting new book about it, and in it he writes, "The Great Reset is a multi-tentacled, many-headed hydra of mythical proportions. This monstrosity is entangling itself with every conceivable area of life. The Great Reset Project has already reached into and altered the behavior of nearly every industry, multinational corporation, local and national government, and our personal lives. It harnesses the information technology and biotechnology sectors to establish a stranglehold on the entire world," unquote. So today we're going to explore the agenda of the Great Reset with my guest and get an understanding of what it's about, who's behind it and why, and what we can do about it. So please stay with us and don't forget to hit that subscribe button to make sure you don't miss any of the great conversations like this that we're having here at the intersection of politics and culture. When people refer to someone as being the smartest guy in the room, the guy they're talking about is my guest today at the Right Take Podcast. Michael Rechtenwald is a dissident scholar. He's the author of many books ranging from poetry to fiction to literary criticism to cultural criticism, some of which I've either reviewed or interviewed him about for Front Page Mag, such as Springtime for Snowflakes, The Google Archipelago, Thought Criminal, and Beyond Woke. He is a relentlessly thought-provoking and insightful critic of the woke forces that threaten our culture and our language and our freedoms and even our very thoughts. Ever since I launched the Right Take Podcast, I've been looking forward to having him on the show, and now he's here. Michael Rechtenwald, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm going to just go right ahead and invite you to come back another time to talk about the whole range of ideas presented in your other books and even your own background as a target of cancel culture, which is a fascinating story on its own, because there's no way I can get to all of that stuff in one episode. And so today I'm just going to focus on your latest book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, and the subtitle of which is Unraveling the Global Agenda. Let's begin with kind of an overview of this agenda. I think people have heard about the Great Reset more and more often since the Democrats took over in 2021, but most people might be at kind of a loss as to how to clearly define it. Now, this is going to be a big question, but can you give us a sort of a digestible definition of what the Great Reset is?
Sure. The Great Reset is really the World Economic Forum's promise to accelerate the achievement of the UN's 2030 agenda. And so it really is about bringing to pass the sustainable development goals of the UN's 2030 agenda. It means to do this by forming public-private partnerships with major corporations and other organizations, other NGOs, and to influence various states or stakeholders, as they would call them, in bringing about Agenda 2030. And Agenda 2030 is aimed at sustainable development. And so there's some 17 points of Agenda 2030, and all of them are aimed at sustainable development, so-called. And likewise, in order to bring about this sustainable development, the World Economic Forum has basically corralled and connected with and influenced major corporations. They have over 1,000 major corporate partners that are signed on to their agenda to bring about stakeholder capitalism, which is the means by which they mean to reset the economy in order to meet the Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. So we could then plumb into the Sustainable Development Goals, if you wish, or go from there.
Let me back up just a second. You mentioned that the World Economic Forum and its chief, Klaus Schwab. What exactly is the World Economic Forum, and who is Klaus Schwab? What constitutes this entity, and what's their mission? You talked about it, you know, being supportive of Agenda 2030, but is there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, there's definitely more to it than that, and it is necessary to understand what the World Economic Forum. So the World Economic Forum is a international NGO that was established in 1971 as the European Management Forum. And it soon morphed into, it was basically developed as a means for which corporations and so forth could effectively deal with their corporate management issues. But then it soon morphed into an NGO for global governance. And that started in 1974 with the collapse of Bretton Woods and the Arab-Israeli War. And then in 1987, the European Management Forum changed its name to the World Economic Forum. And they now define themselves as the International Organization for Public-Private Cooperation. So their MO is public-private cooperation, and that's their main role. Their role is to basically aid and abet these international governance bodies like the UN to institute the Agenda 2030, to bring it about, and they do it through this stakeholder capitalism. They have 1,000 corporate partners, and these are major corporate partners from all around the world, not just in the United States, inclusive of companies in China and elsewhere. So all of these organizations, these corporations, are effectively signed on to stakeholder capitalism. And stakeholder capitalism is a means by which they will establish this new world economic system, which is aimed at sustainable development, inclusive of like treating and mitigating climate change, and of course, bringing about what they call sustainability and equity in the world. And all of that is really laden. It's all laid out in Agenda 2030 and what they mean to establish by virtue of the Great Reset really can be read from the Agenda 2030 pages.
And the sustainable development that you're talking about, does that tie into this, the whole exploitation of this climate change catastrophism that you write about in the book?
Oh, absolutely. The climate change catastrophism is the main underpinning pretext for the Great Reset. I mean, there are other things. They've used most proximately the COVID crisis as a rationale and pretext for bringing about the Great Reset. But climate change is the overriding background issue, and it's the one that they have been, they're going to turn to probably next in greater force and have been doing so for some time now. But they'll probably be redoubling their efforts in that regard. But the climate change is really the main thing they're trying to mitigate, so-called climate change. And so they have formed a partnership with the UN. This was signed in 2019 to accelerate Agenda 2030, which aims at sustainable development goals. And there's, as I said, there's 17 of them. And all of them really amount to trying to bring about this development that is effectively changed greatly, especially in the first world, and also to make sure that the developing world does not develop unsustainably. And all, you know, there's many points to this, which we can go into in terms of Agenda 2030. But yeah.
And how does, I wanted to ask about woke capitalism too. Maybe this isn't the right point to interject this, but how does woke capitalism figure into this? And what's the difference between that and stakeholder capitalism? I know some conservatives who think that wokeness is kind of on its way out, that it can't sustain itself, that the woke will start to eat each other. Is that a naive attitude? Is woke capitalism actually sort of here to stay? Because conservatives I know will say, oh, you know, for companies that get woke go broke. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, I would say that that phrase, go woke and go broke, should be banished at least temporarily in lieu of the phrase go woke or go broke. Because the way that this is being managed is such that if you don't go woke, if you don't abide by the environmental, social, and governance indexing that's being foisted on us by the major asset managers such as BlackRock, Inc., State Street, the Vanguard Group, and others, then you will not have capital assets directed at your company. You will be starved of capital. So woke capitalism is a way of actually dividing the woke wheat from the unwoke chaff, starving off the latter and feeding the former. It's a kind of cartel scheme, really, at base. It's a shared monopoly scheme that aims to eliminate competition by virtue of starving them of capital assets. And so when we talk about woke capitalism, people are thinking simply things like Disney and other corporations that are virtue signaling to their consumer base, or their leftist consumer base at least. But it is really much more penetrating than that. It's a top-down agenda that's being foisted by these asset managers who are all connected to the World Economic Forum, by the way. They are partners and board members and things like that in the World Economics Foundation Board. And so they are driving woke capitalism. It is, if we consider woke capitalism to take into stakeholder capitalism as part of it, or as basically the same thing, then indeed it isn't go woke and go broke. It's go woke or go broke.
And this Great Reset, it's already, the Biden administration is already on board with all this, of course, right? It's already underway, this Great Reset. The Biden administration has already implemented some steps to participate or get this agenda kickstarted, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've signed over 12 Biden's signed over 12 executive orders aimed at climate change mitigation, and then has committed the largest amount of funds ever committed to climate change with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. I think it was some $287 billion committed to mitigating climate change in that bill. So there's no question. And, you know, the old Build Back Better, which has seemed to has dropped out of the lexicon, is really the equivalent of the Great Reset. It's been used interchangeably by Great Reset advocates like King Charles and previously the Prince. He was really the person who kicked off the Great Reset formally. And, you know, on his website, when he was the Prince, he equated Build Back Better with the Great Reset itself. Biden's totally on board with the Great Reset. And the Build Back Better nomenclature is effectively the same agenda, it stands for the same agenda as the Great Reset.
What's the ultimate economic aim of the Great Reset and of the World Economic Forum? Is it ultimately some form of socialism? I mean, I'm reminded of this slogan that emerged, I think, from the World Economic Forum: "You'll own nothing and be happy," which sounds, well, I'm sure they intended for that to sound inspirational, but it sounds more like a threat.
Well, I would call it, what I call it is corporate socialism, because what it establishes is a set of corporate cartel on top in conjunction and in connection and in total cooperation with the state, and a kind of actually existing socialism on the ground for the vast majority. So it implements actually existing socialism was a phrase used by dissidents in the Soviet Union to describe, you know, how socialism actually is when it's enacted, not how it's supposed to be according to the to Marx and his epigons. But it's really a static system whereby you don't have economic mobility, you don't have economic prospects. There is the elimination of the middle class, effectively, a kind of, you know, the socialists have always aimed and destroyed the, you know, what they call the petty bourgeoisie first. And this is really what it does. It's kind of a monopoly scheme where you have these, you know, preferred, endorsed and, you know, and approved producers on top in conjunction with the state. And you have the elimination of the middle class below, and effectively everybody living under actually existing socialism. I think that's the actual outcome. They wouldn't put it that way, but they almost did when saying you'll own nothing and be happy. It's very much, that was Ida Auken, by the way, the first Danish politician chosen to be a young global leader for the World Economic Forum, and also a major Danish figure. She basically wrote this in a blog post that was removed from the World Economic Forum's website, but remains on Forbes, on the Forbes website, ironically. I mean, Forbes has been a major proponent of the Great Reset and the WEF's agenda.
Has there been anything like this in the past? What is this? You know, what I'm reminded of, and you actually mentioned this in the book, is Mao's Great Leap Forward. And you have a chapter with a great title, Great Leap Backward. Can you sort of elaborate on that a little bit and about what connects those two, these two disastrous agendas?
Yes. I mean, Mao's Great Leap Forward was intended to bring about this acceleration of production agriculturally and industrially to raise the standards of living of the peasants and the rest of the country, and to enrich the state with more agricultural output and industrial output. It was absurd the way it was implemented. It was they basically took all of these farmers and turned them into metallurgists, in effect, putting small blast furnaces in on back porches and backyards, and converting steel into, I mean, converting all objects into steel. It was a total disaster, of course. It eventuated the worst famine in recorded human history. Of 20 to 43 million people died, either of starvation or murder. The thing that they have, but the Great Reset really aims at lowering the standards of living around the world, especially in the developed world, because they see the developed world as unsustainable. So they really have been after reducing, and they've said this in many ways, and directly saying that wealth is the greatest enemy of mankind. One of the WEF contributors said this: wealth is the greatest enemy of mankind. So they've been trying to reduce the wealth, particularly in the first or developing world, and they have. But the thing that the Great Reset and the Great Leap Forward, so-called, have in common is that they involve this ideological imposition on nature and on human society. This imposition of an ideological, unscientific worldview, and it will similarly result in disaster. It will bring about a great leap backward for humanity if it's brought to its full fruition.
You know, I often say that this utopian impulse to engineer a perfect society, it inevitably leads to totalitarianism. There's just no way to perfect a fallen humanity without authoritarian coercion. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's utopianism is always totalitarianism in waiting. Every utopian has this idea of what their utopia is, and they must, you know, basically coerce the population into abiding by their utopian scheme, likewise abrogating their rights, and sometimes their very lives are sacrificed on the altar of utopianism. And this is very much the case here. This Great Reset would lead to famine. It would lead to misery, miseration, and totalitarian control, which is where the technology comes in. The means to control the population are being ushered in vis-a-vis what they're calling the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which has all these technological, it's a panoply of technologies meant to control basically everything, all behavior, from CBDCs to a digital identity to even the metaverse, I argue.
Let's shift a little bit away from the economics toward that kind of, toward some other social issues here. Like, are we headed toward, and I almost already know the answer to this, but are we headed in the United States and in the Western world toward the sort of social credit system that China already has implemented? And is that part of the Great Reset?
Absolutely, that's part of the Great Reset. And we are headed that way. And it will be instituted vis-a-vis digital identity and CBDC, and basically carbon footprint tracking and other elements that will effectively rate you as a person. And, you know, for example, this digital identity is not merely some form of identification. It is a complete digital record of your life. And what it will do is basically track and trace and surveil you from the cradle to the grave. It amounts to a complete database on all your activity, and it sets up a kind of political profiling system, much like the social credit score system in China. And effectively, you'll be rated by how well you abide by the dictates of the global corporate socialist agenda. Like, are you consuming too much carbon? Are you eating too much meat? Do you have the right political views? In other words, are you a believer in climate change catastrophism or not? All of these things could figure into a kind of social profile which would then lend itself to a scoring system.
And there will be no way to avoid participating in that kind of a system, will there?
Well, I think that we can refuse it. It's just that the problem is it's being implemented incrementally. So incrementalism is the means by which they're undertaking all this. So it'll be slowly and surely implemented incrementally. You'll see different corporations, for example, floating digital identities, probably banks first, and then they'll be connecting these to this digital profile to your spending and debt and savings through the CBDC and so on and so forth. So what we have to watch out for is buying in to these incremental implementations. We have to resist them at all points, and they'll be subtle in many cases. And they'll sell themselves as advantages, as enhancements, as convenience, as even as security and privacy. So, you know, you basically have to look at everything they say and invert it. So when they talk about inclusion, it means exclusion. When they talk about equity, it means inequity. It means basically robbing you of your property. It's insidious. That's one of the difficulties anyone will have reading, for example, the World Economic Forum's literature or the UN's literature. Everything is cast in all these euphemisms and doublespeak. And they try to put all their objectives in the most altruistic language you can imagine. But all you have to do is read this closely and see what it amounts to, what the implications are, and then it unfurls or unravels, if you will.
Another thing you hear about a lot these days is artificial intelligence and advances in that, and also advances in biotechnology. In my opening remarks, I referenced a video clip of a talk by this author, Yuval Harari, the Israeli philosopher who was just salivating in this video, talking about what he called the hacking of humanity. And you write a little bit about him. You mention him in your book. And this hacking of humanity he refers to as transhumanism. What is transhumanism? And why should we worry about what that means for the future of humanity?
Okay, well, that's a great question. Transhumanism, of course, means transcending the human condition or being human. It promises a kind of godlike capabilities. You'll have all this, the world's knowledge at your fingertips, or even better, at the ends of your neurons, and you'll be able to have superhuman capacities, and perhaps even extended life, or even, according to them, people like Harari, even eternal life for the elite, we may assume. Really, transhumanism is really another term for eugenics. Frankly, it was a rebranding of eugenics when it was first introduced. And it was introduced by Huxley, not Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, but his brother. His brother Julian Huxley was a eugenicist and transhumanist. And so they really rebranded eugenics, which means, of course, good breeding. And the object there is to produce, superior human beings. Well, transhumanism does the same, but virtually through technological means rather than strictly genetic ones. And Harari, the promise of transhumanism has been floated by people like Ray Kurzweil and others, and it's been suggested that it holds all this tremendous promise for everybody. But I think Harari is unique in suggesting that really it only applies and will only apply to the elite. Only they will have these godlike powers, and everyone else will sort of be under their in their thrall and under their control. And according to Yuval Harari, they will be useless eaters, in effect. they'll be useless people. He's used that exact phraseology. And they'll have nothing to do except perhaps dwell in the metaverse and take drugs. I mean, he said this explicitly. And he is a real, you know, he is an intimate advisor of Klaus Schwab and the WEF. So we have to take these people seriously. Take them at their word because they mean it.
So they don't so much see themselves as facilitators of elevating all of humankind to this sort of next level of evolution. They see themselves mostly as elevating themselves and their fellow elites and then just completely dominating the mass of mankind. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it's made very explicit, and Harari says things like the free will is history, and with AI and brain cloud interfaces, basically you could be under complete control. Brain cloud interfaces means a connection of your brain directly to the cloud, which means, of course, not only that your thoughts would be transmitted to the cloud, but thoughts will be transmitted to you from the cloud, which means total control and the abrogation of free will. That's really what they have in mind. And they think this is necessary because these useless eaters are not only unsustainable, they're an obstacle to this transcendent state that these elitists would like to establish for themselves.
At the risk of getting a little too metaphysical about this, I don't know of any better way to describe this agenda than the word evil. Do these people see themselves as kind of the saviors of mankind in a way, or are they just deluded and misguided so much that they can't recognize the evil that this will lead to, or are they just evil?
Well, I think they're evil. Of course, nobody really that is evil thinks they're evil. They, of course, have to go to bed at night like everybody else. So they have to tell themselves fanciful lies that will allow them to sleep at night. So they assume that this is good for everybody and it's good for the world. It's kind of like iRobot, you know, the movie and the short story on which it was based. And that is that, you know, in order to save humanity from itself, these people need to be basically controlled by AI and robotics. And they, you know, even if you follow Asimov's three laws of robotics, you know, the AI could determine that you're better off in prison than having free emotion and free self-determination. So, yeah, they're talking about hacking humanity with AI and biometric surveillance technologies and suggesting that, you know, basically human beings can be replaced and functionally replaced by AI and robotics. And likewise, they become useless. And then what do we do with them? That's effectively where they're coming from. And that's why they consider basically things like the metaverse and other means of like pacification and, you know, basically replacing the real world incentives and rewards with these faux ones in virtual reality.
You know, the COVID pandemic exposed just how willingly an alarming percentage of the population is to embrace their own enslavement. Are you optimistic or pessimistic that people will be able to resist this globalist agenda, especially as insidious as it is? Now, I know you've got a chapter about, you know, a plan to resist this, and I'd like to get to that in a minute. But just in terms of people's willingness to recognize what's being done to them and to resist it, how optimistic are you, pessimistic are that enough people will revolt?
Well, I'm very optimistic that there'll be at least a remnant of human beings that will resist and that will survive and that will pass on the values of freedom, you know, of liberty, individual self-determination, inclusive of, I believe, as necessary for the former, the free market. And so I believe in a remnant, at least, will survive this. And that's the minimal hope. The maximal hope is that we will have a majority of the population. And I think in the United States, we do have a majority. That majority is not given voice politically. That majority is not given voice, you know, technologically. It's being suppressed. It's being censored. It's being memory-holed. It's being disappeared on the internet through the big digital, which I've treated in Google Archipelago pretty substantially. But I think that nevertheless, there is a very serious and significant contingent of the population, especially in the United States, that will resist and overcome.
Yes, good. Also, since the COVID pandemic, I think people have become pretty hyper aware of the fact that the more the media and the globalist elites dismiss something as conspiracy theory, the more guaranteed it actually is to be true. You have a chapter that addresses that in the context of the Great Reset. What is your response to people who say that all of this is just conspiracy theory?
Well, the first thing is I would say is that, for one, I believe that these globalists generate conspiratorial thinking, and perhaps on purpose, in order to discredit all criticism and deflect all criticism. In other words, if they can plant seeds that will lead to conspiratorial thinking, then they can dismiss them with the ready epithet of conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorists or conspiracist thinking. And I believe they actually plant the seeds of this on purpose in order to bait people into what they can deem conspiracy theory in order to utterly avoid and deflect all criticism of this agenda. Secondly, and I talk about this in the chapter called The Question of Conspiracy Theory, I believe it is an unfounded dismissal of real arguments. In other words, this whole idea of conspiracy theory really was floated first by Karl Popper in his book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, in 1944. I don't have all the dates perfectly in my mind here, but there's a lot of dates and people and topics in this book, and some of them I can't even remember myself. There's so much. But that dismissal was really a straw man. Karl Popper came up with this idea of the conspiracy theory of society, in which he suggested that, you know, a conspiracy theory of society suggests that all events and all outcomes are the result of conspiracies. Then he dismissed that theory. It really was a straw man, because nobody really suggests that. There isn't anybody that says that everything that happens on Earth is the result of conspiracy. Then the CIA picked up this phraseology in connection with JFK's assassination and began to discredit all opposition to the official narrative as conspiracy theory. And it's been used ever since. It's really a CIA, CIA inaugurated phrase. And it's picked up its negative connotations from that, because I went back and looked at the history of the use of this phrase, and it wasn't always negative at all. The earliest usage I could find was late 19th century. There was no opprobrium attached to the idea of floating a conspiracy theory. It was just a kind of theory, because conspiracies obviously happen. Just having a conspiracy theory or something, you can't disqualify an argument on that basis. So the CIA, you know, began using this epithet conspiracy theory, which I believe they picked up from Karl Popper, and used it to discredit all alternative explanations for official narratives, like in the case of the JFK assassination. And then they, you know, basically promulgated this phrase to discredit anything that disagreed with official narratives on any event. And then, so it became a ready epithet to throw it at all theories that disagreed with the official theories or narratives. And then, but I should say that, you know, when I adjudicate this question in the book, a conspiracy, a theory is not wrong for being a conspiracy theory. The question is whether it conforms with the evidence or not. And so I think that the phrase, you know, should be retired, or, and it probably won't be, but we should disregard all those who use that epithet to discredit our inquiries, period. And that's where I would leave it.
You know, I think a lot of people feel overwhelmed by all of these issues and threats that you raise in the book in the context of the Great Reset. I know I feel that way. I feel like it's something that is just beyond my ability to oppose, because the globalist agenda is in the control of this network of wealthy elites who are just way too powerful and entrenched for the little people to do anything about. But reading your book, I think, is probably the first time I have felt any kind of hope or being empowered about opposing that agenda. But without giving away any spoilers, can you talk a bit about the chapter in which you refer to your 9-point plan for stopping the Great Reset? You call it the Great Refusal.
The Grand Refusal, yes. So basically what I'm suggesting here is that we can oppose this Great Reset by virtue of refusing the elements that are being rolled out as part of it. Okay, so that means, and I call this a 9-point plan for stopping the Great Reset as part of a grand refusal. And I'm not suggesting this is comprehensive, these 9 points, but they are specific points that we can refuse the Great Reset on. We can refuse the central bank digital currency. Just refuse it when it comes down the pike. Don't use it. We can reject this Internet of Bodies technologies, the installation of devices in our body, the metaverse, and the transhumanism that they're holding out as enhancements and as, you know, as superhuman capacities. We should reject them, because this is a bait and switch routine. We can refuse the digital identity, which is being rolled out under the rubric of inclusion. But inclusion really means exclusion of those who don't abide. And it's really a totalitarian system that would try to include everybody in it. Anytime they speak of inclusion and total inclusion, you have to think about totalitarianism, because they're trying to create a totality and which can't be opted out from, except that we can opt out from it. And a major point is just continue to practice the free market in your life. Reduce your dependence, or eliminate your dependence on the state, and disengage from establishment institutions, and especially educational institutions, whose mission largely is to indoctrinate and brainwash people and to make them willing subjects of the entire agenda. Be as entrepreneurial as you possibly can. Buy locally from local farmers. This is all part of establishing parallel economics and a parallel economic system and parallel social networks. And then the other elements have to do with the ESG index and refusing to buy and divesting from ESG traded funds, ESG indexed funds. Transfer your investments into non-ESG reporting stocks and EFTs, and hopefully assist in bringing antitrust legislation against ESG investing, because it is a monopoly scheme. And there are members of Congress who know this. They know that this is the case. And there is a contingent that will support these efforts. And remove your money from ESG reporting banks, because you're feeding the beast. And that includes most of the major banks, especially Bank of America. They're big proponents of of stakeholder capitalism and ESG reporting. Put extreme pressure on legislators to divest from ESGs, to protect national and sovereignty and individual rights, to divest and dissociate from the World Economic Forum. We're actually cooperating with the World Economic Forum under the Biden regime. Withdraw from the UN. This is to pressure our representatives to withdraw from the UN and the World Health Organization, which is its child, and pressure your legislators to withdraw their state and other pensions from ESG index stocks. And this is happening in many states across the country, especially in the South. There's a whole contingent of governors that are pulling out their pensions from ESG stocks. And there's to encourage defection, the defection of others and the elites from this globalist agenda. I believe there are elites who oppose this agenda, and they would, if they were in their right mind, oppose it. And I think Elon Musk is a potential one, although he is an ambiguous character. At least he is a possible ally to some extent. And then simply network with like-minded individuals to spread this plan of opposition digitally and analogically or in person. All of these are just steps or part of what I'm calling this grand refusal.
Excellent. There are a lot of great ideas there that will help people feel like they can actually do something about this instead of just feeling overwhelmed by forces that are above and beyond their control. Again, listeners, the book is called The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty. It's out now from New English Review Press. It's absolutely the go-to book to unravel and understand this whole terrifying agenda. Michael, is there any idea what you will be working on next?
Oh, that's a great question, Mark. Possibly I might be working on a testimony of my faith. And I'm going out on a limb saying this, that it might alienate some of my followers and fans, but that's just the way it is. That's a possible direction that I might go, because I think that is really the only foundational way that we can maintain our sanity and our hope for the future. And also, I think in the end, this is a spiritual battle, and I think it's important to come out clean on the table about where one stands with reference to these very, as you would put it, metaphysical issues. And so that's possibly the next book that I will write.
Oh, I very much look forward to that. I'm often saying that this is a spiritual battle that we're in, so I'm kind of excited to hear you bring that up as something that you're trying to incorporate or that you're wrestling with. So very interesting. Michael Rechtenwald, thanks for sharing your insights with us here today at the Right Take Podcast. Love to have you back sometime to talk about whatever else is on your mind. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Mark. Great to be here.
The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.